AIDS brings a response from the government.
AIDS, the disease which claims life.
Welcome to AIDS: The Lost Voices with me, William Hampson, alongside the heartfelt diary of America's own, Dave Partridge. Dave was diagnosed with AIDS in 1987. His diary, a regular fixture in Illinois' Herald and Review newspaper, sharing his journey of fear, hope and resilience, giving a voice to those often overlooked. Digits ready? Let's go. This was his personal legacy, a searing reminder of the horrors of AIDS, stated the Herald and Review newspaper of Illinois in the United States. Yet, what good is a legacy if it remains unseen in the newspaper archives? To ensure that Dave Partridge's voice resonates beyond the confines of dusty newspaper pages, his poignant diary, penned under the alias Jacob, inspired by the character from Le Cage aux Folles, serves as a powerful testament to his experiences. In the previous episode, Dave turned 33 and faced a series of health challenges, and a chance encounter while undergoing a medical trial reunited Dave with an old friend who'd been recently diagnosed with AIDS. His pneumonia led to two hospitalizations and a brief pause in AZT in a bid to aid his recovery. He began treatment for Kaposi sarcoma and was even called upon to provide peer support to someone newly diagnosed with HIV who was contemplating suicide. A trip to Chicago for a sinus consultation brought no improvements to his sinus issues, to the dismay of his doctors who referred him. A potential connection with a reader of his journal while also living with AIDS in North Carolina didn't develop as he hoped. However, after having his remaining teeth extracted, Dave felt triumphant receiving his dentures, which restored his confidence and restored a bit of normality to his life. Chapter 31, published on the 25th of March, 1990. Ugh, night sweats get me down. I wake up in the middle of the night feeling like someone has splashed gasoline on my body and lit a match. Night sweats go along with AIDS. Some patients develop night sweats sooner than others. Many have them at the very beginning of AIDS. I was spared, until a few weeks ago. After I've had one, I have to change bedclothes and underwear. Everything gets soaked with sweat. Because of this, I haven't been getting a lot of sleep. I try to take naps, but I can't fool my body by sleeping in the afternoon. I end up having night sweats during the day. Sometimes, I don't even have to be asleep. I've had night sweats when I'm awake. When I start getting hot, I peel off clothes. When the sweating passes, I put clothes back on so I don't chill. Nothing can be done for them. There's no medicine to stop night sweats. I've talked to other AIDS patients who have them. No one has reported their night sweats miraculously ceasing. I guess I'll have to learn to live with them. On March 9th, I started radiation treatment for Kaposi sarcoma, the age-related cancer I was diagnosed with a year ago. This affliction produces telltale purplish-black spots. They're like a badge, marking many AIDS patients. The lesions are mostly on my calves. Have they gotten worse in the last year? You tell me. Jacob rolls up a pant leg to reveal purple blotches covering his legs from the knees down. They're also on my arms, mostly from the elbows down, and a couple of places on my chest. The spots turn red at first, then they turn purple, finally black. I still don't have any spots on my face. I hope I don't get any. I've got enough everywhere else. The radiation treatment wasn't bad. It didn't make me sick. I stretched out on a table and laser lights marked where the radiation was supposed to go. The lights went out and the radiation started. It took 15 to 20 minutes for both legs. "What do you think of that?" the technician asked. I said, "It was real boring." Doctors tell me I may not need another treatment, that one blast probably killed a lot of the cancer cells on the legs. Now I wait for them to be carried away by my body. The radiation is not going to cure the Kaposis. There's no cure, but radiation should slow down the spread of the cancer. But with only one treatment, I've already seen a difference. My physician, Dr. James Wade III, said it would only make my legs as beautiful as they used to be. It doesn't really matter, though. I usually wear jeans and no one sees my legs. When summertime, shorts weather, rolls around, I'm not going to worry about my splotchy legs. I went into the hospital at 6 a.m. on Monday to get my nose worked on again. Last year, in May, I had two surgeries to get rid of sinus infection and polyps blocking my breathing. I was in the hospital for 17 days, but the problem never completely went away. Since the last round of surgeries, my doctor had been afraid to operate. They thought I might hemorrhage or get an infection. Finally, I told them I wanted it done because the polyps were getting quite painful. Dr. Wade approved the surgery, so he must feel like I'm up to it. I wasn't scared. I trust my doctors and I figure if I get an infection or if I hemorrhage, I'm in the right place. Through all of this, they are keeping me on intravenous antibiotics to guard against infection. Doctors say I'll be home in a few days. I'm counting on a week at least. I've never been in the hospital for less than a week. On Tuesday, my second night in the hospital, I got real sick to my stomach. There was no warning, just boom. I was sick everywhere. On the bed, the wall, all over me. I had to call for help. Then afterward, I think it was afterward, I had what I call a seizure. I stiffened up and shook all over. I've had three of these seizures now, dating back to a year ago. By Wednesday noon, I still had not been to sleep. The nurses had given me a pain shot and I was pretty groggy. My doctors say my episodes probably aren't seizures but reactions to something. I'm not sure if they know why it happens. It's probably just another fact of my life. Chapter 32, published on the 28th of May, 1990. Yay! I'm moving! I'm leaving my one-room efficiency apartment. My new home will be a small, two-bedroom house several blocks away. I think it's going to be a good move. It's not that my old place was terrible. I moved there because I needed an affordable place to live. It fit the bill. Now it's time to find a little more comfort. My old apartment had no kitchen, just a corner that I made into a kitchen by adding a refrigerator, microwave and shelves. The house has a dining room and a small kitchen. A real kitchen! I have to fix the oven though. My old apartment had a half bath, no shower, no tub. For 2 years I've been taking sponge baths. The house has a real bathroom with a real bathtub. My old apartment had no windows. The house has windows. It's going to be great just to be able to look outside. I feel like a whole world has been opened up to me. And the house is ground level, no stairs. To get to my old apartment, I had to climb down a short flight of stairs. To get out, I had to climb up, which was even tougher. Stairs wear me out. I found my new place by answering a classified ad in the newspaper. Yes, I have a roommate. At first, I wasn't going to tell him I have AIDS. I'd thought I'd just let him find out on his own. But AIDS is a hard secret to keep. I have bottles of medicine sitting everywhere, and there are lots of days when I feel lousy. How would I explain that? I got to thinking, if he finds out, he'll get upset. He could boot me out the door. I wouldn't have any place to go. So, I told him. He said it didn't matter. Friend of Jacob's and journalist at the Herald and Review newspaper, Amy Ragsdale, who's helping Jacob publish his journal in the newspaper, gives us a little bit of insight into Jacob's roommate, where she states, Jacob's roommate is a 24-year-old man. Recently divorced, he works as a cook in a restaurant. He's been living alone and needs someone to share the expenses. Jacob came over here a couple of days before he told me, the man said. When I found out, I was shocked, but I decided I would not discriminate against him. I know I cannot catch AIDS just from talking to him or sitting next to him. I've known other people who had AIDS who died of AIDS. I told Jacob, move in. The man doesn't want his name printed. I haven't told my friends or my parents that my roommate has AIDS. They would probably be worried. Returning to Jacob's journal, he goes on to write, moving is never a pleasant task. I think it's easier to pack to move across country than pack to move across town. I had about a truckload and a half of stuff. I'm giving away most of my furniture, but I'll still have a television set, lots of clothes, my stereo, and lots of records. Those stacks of albums get heavy fast. A couple of friends with a truck moved me last weekend. They said I'd get moved hell or high water, which, if you remember the weather, was exactly the case. I didn't have to move my fish, I got rid of them, and I gave away the aquarium equipment. You should have given me the fish. I like fish. Jacob's roommate interjects. I love pets. I have a cat. Jacob smirks. And it's going to have kittens. Since my last journal, I've been back in the hospital. I was running a high fever. My doctors wanted to find out why. Oh, more needles. As it turned out, I had pneumonia in one lung. I don't even know what kind of pneumonia it was. It cleared up without any special medicine. I'm hoping that means my immune system still has some oomph. Along with the pneumonia, I had an extreme case of thrush. I've had thrush on and off for years, but never this bad. I could feel the thrush in the back of my throat. It didn't interfere with my eating, though. My doctor, James Wade III, gave me a new drug for thrush. It's called Diflucan. It's not cheap. $75 for 10 pills. Public Aid picked up the bill. I took one tablet every morning and it seemed to work. The thrush is gone. For how long? I don't know. I imagine I'll always have flare-ups. Since I wrote last, AIDS patient Ryan White died. Hearing about another AIDS patient dying bothers me a little bit. It just makes me think, what might be in store for me down the road? In a few months, I'll have my third anniversary of living with AIDS. I was diagnosed with full-blown AIDS in August 1987, but I suspect I've been sicker longer than the doctors think. Considering it's been 3, maybe even 4 years, I think I'm doing pretty well. Dr. Wade seems to be happy with my blood work. My next doctor's appointment is coming up this week. Spots for Kaposi sarcoma, the age-related cancer I've had for a year, have continued to fade after the radiation treatment in early March. I still take AZT, the drug that is supposed to prolong the life of AIDS patients. I've taken it for 2 years, 2 pills, 3 times a day. You'd think it would be a habit, but I still forget. I've got the bottle of capsules right here in front of me, but I ignore them. I'm tired of taking them. One of these days, I'm going to wake up and discover that I've turned into a little white capsule with a blue band around it. Chapter 33, published on the 8th of July, 1990. My liver quit working. About 1.5 weeks ago, it told my body, I've had enough. When I went in for a routine checkup, I didn't realise my skin and eyes looked yellow. Then my physician, Dr. James Wade III, said, according to your lab work, your blood work, you are jaundiced. I was knocked down, taken by total surprise. I panicked. I knew jaundice was a symptom of hepatitis. Luckily, tests showed I didn't have hepatitis. I was admitted to Decatur Memorial Hospital on June 27th. The specialist told me my liver problems were probably a combination of taking so much medicine and drinking. I had been taking 3 kinds of medicine. AZT, the life-prolonging AIDS drug, a sleeping pill, and an antidepressant. In the hospital, the doctors took me off all those, except the AZT. Then, the specialist asked me about my drinking habit. I told him, I've been drinking about 8 beers a day. For me, that's good. There was a time when I could drink 8 beers plus a quart of vodka every day. I know my doctors would prefer I just stop drinking altogether, but I enjoy it. I like the taste and the way it makes me feel. It makes me relax. It makes me sleep. It takes my mind off being sick. But for my liver's sake, I'm trying to cut back and I'm doing real good. I'm probably down to about 5 beers a day. I spent 4 days in the hospital. No booze. Healthy food. It did the trick. Jump-started my liver. I know I'm not out of the woods, but I feel okay. I've lost 6 pounds since last month. Right now, I weigh 137. Before I went into the hospital, I was down to eating 1 meal a day, maybe. I had no appetite, none. I could cook, but by the time the meal was ready, I didn't want anything. When I did eat, everything came back up. Doctors said the nausea might have been caused by my liver problems. The cancer blotches on my legs and arms have started to hurt. Kind of a dull ache. The blotches are most aggravating when they itch. I scratch them and the splotches become inflamed. I tell myself not to scratch, but it feels good at the time. I've got no new spots, but they're still confined to my arms and legs. None on my face, yet. My stepfather died May the 17th from cancer. I'm not sure how long he had it. He wasn't sure either. He refused to go to the doctor for a long time. He finally was diagnosed about a month before he died. He went to Dr. Wade, the same doctor I use. I saw my stepfather the day before he died. He was at home until the end. That day when I left, I told him, I'll see you later. The next morning, my mom called and told me he had died. Asked if he had been close to his stepfather, Jacob clouds up. We had a bond, he said. Recently, I was introduced to a woman, a friend of a friend. She didn't know I had AIDS and I was afraid to tell her. I worried that she might get upset and convince our mutual friend to shy away from me. She began to ask questions. First, she wanted to know why I didn't work. Then, when I landed in the hospital, She was curious about why I had a private room. So, I told her I had cancer. I do, Kaposi sarcoma. That seemed to satisfy her. I'm not ashamed of my condition, yet there are a lot of people who wouldn't talk to me if they knew I had AIDS. So, sometimes I compromise the truth. I tell half the story so everyone is comfortable. When I'm around people who are uptight, it makes me uptight. Being uptight, stress helps break down my immune system. It's a vicious circle. People used to be afraid to say they had cancer because other people treated them differently. Some people even thought they could catch cancer. Today, cancer is acceptable. AIDS is not. People still don't realise that AIDS is not easily transmitted. Most of us contracted the virus through sex or dirty needles during intravenous drug use. It didn't just float through the air and attack us. We gave the virus an invitation to invade our bodies. I've been feeling a lot of stress, partly because of my new living situation. I think it had a lot to do with my becoming ill. You see, I forget what it was like to have a roommate. I moved out of my basement efficiency apartment a little more than a month ago. Now I live in a small house with a roommate. I had lived alone for 3 years. It's hard to get used to having someone around all the time. Although I'm pretty flexible because I don't work, I still have to adjust to someone else's clock. It's harder to plan meals, do household chores, everything. My mother bought me a washing machine. Before I went into the hospital, I laid down the law to my roommate. I am the only one to use the washing machine. That way, if the machine breaks down, there is no one else but myself to blame. Unfortunately, my lecture didn't work. When I was in the hospital, my roommate used the washing machine. That made me angry. Now that I'm home, I've told my roommate and his girlfriend, I will do the laundry. They have to carry their dirty clothes down to the basement. I will wash them. Then, they have to pick up their wet clothes and hang them out to dry. I don't mind being the house laundryman. It's a job that I can do without getting worn out. Actually, I enjoy doing the laundry. Chapter 34, Goodbyes Are Never Easy, published on the 9th of September, 1990. I'm slipping. The doctors say so, but hell, I knew that a long time ago. Nothing can be done, sir. I might as well accept it. After all, I've done a lot, seen a lot. I realise other AIDS patients have gone through this same slow process, but that doesn't make it any easier. Friend and journalist Amy Ragsdale is sat alongside Jacob and she gives the following insight. Always wiry, the 5 foot 10 inch Jacob weighed 150 pounds when diagnosed with AIDS. Today, he says his weight has dropped to 107, but he looks even thinner. A thumb and forefinger can easily encircle his tiny wrists. His legs have dwindled to mere sticks. His facial bones jut over sunken cheeks, but his feet, they're swollen twice their normal size. Elephant feet, Jacob scoffs, lifting his legs and showing off his new slippers, a gift from a friend. I'll never get my boots on, Jacob added. He and I have talked about what to do now he is failing so rapidly, says Jacob's physician Dr. James Wade III. He wants to stay at home. He doesn't want to come to the hospital. He doesn't want any more x-rays and tests. He wants nothing but painkillers. Wade attempts to describe Jacob's pain, quote, the skin cancer lesions hurt, his bones ache, his muscles may well ache. Imagine having the worst cold of your life and multiplying it by 1,000. My butt hurts. All my joints hurt, Jacob moans. He cringes in pain when he shifts only a fraction of an inch. Jacob has spent the past 3 weeks, day and night, on a powder blue crushed velvet couch at a friend's house. I didn't want him staying by himself, says his benefactor, who invited Jacob to spend his dying days with her, her husband, and 3 children. Jacob left his own home after his roommate, a man he met through classified ads, moved into an apartment with a girlfriend. Jacob doesn't think his roommate's departure had anything to do with fear of AIDS. On the couch, beneath Jacob, a beach towel covers a garbage bag. It's for catching things, Jacob tries to explain. His AIDS-racked body often can't move quickly enough to reach the bathroom. In one corner, a walker awaits. I don't go pirouetting, Jacob tries to joke. I keep the walker there in case I need it, Jacob added. Dozens of cancerous lesions from Kaposi sarcoma cover Jacob's legs and arms. Once dry and splotchy, the purple-black lesions are beginning to ooze. It's just another sign that his body's immune system is deteriorating further, Wade remarks. Jacob's skin has turned a deep bronze. The colour is a side effect of AZT, the life-prolonging drug Jacob has taken during most of the 3 years he's battled AIDS. And sometimes the skin can get even darker if the AIDS patient begins to lose the function of his adrenal glands, Wade says. I've been having seizures for a month and a half, 2 months, Jacob confides. The thought of seizures is too painful to describe. Jacob rolls his eyes and drops his head to his chest. His caretaker answers for him. They're like spasms, not like epileptic seizures. They hit him real quick and go away almost as quickly. If he's standing, he'll drop. If he's lying down, he'll just spasm, she says. Once full of wit and merriment, Jacob now falters in mid-sentence, only to drift into oblivion. He awakens with a start, having forgotten what he'd been saying, so he repeats himself over and over. Dozing off again, he smiles and says, I've been thinking of having a picnic. I hope friends will come. He is aware of losing his ability to think and he's frustrated, Wade says. The fogginess, like the seizures, are stark evidence of AIDS burrowing into Jacob's brain. Quote, his intellect is getting worse as the AIDS grows in his brain. There could be other causes also, like infections or another type of cancer. He has many of the manifestations of what we call MAC, or Mycobacterium avium intracellular, Wade says, describing bacteria that attack advanced AIDS patients. Wade goes on to state, it begins to grow throughout all the tissues of the body, the nervous system, all the internal organs, causing weight loss, diarrhea, pneumonia. At noon, Meals on Wheels deliver a hot lunch. Today's fare, rice, asparagus and pork cutlet. Jacob shoves the food around with his fork, absent-mindedly sticks his finger in the rice, then gives up. I've gotten him to eat a couple of bites of this and that, his caretaker says. But you can't force somebody to eat if they don't want to, she added. Hitler, bitch, Jacob lashes out at his caretaker. Gripped by fears of dying alone, Jacob knows his host family soon will find his care too overwhelming. Yeah, I'll probably go to the hospital, Jacob says, sensing the inevitable. To be put in a vault, he added. Many people fear going to the hospital because they're afraid they'll never get out again, Wade says. Jacob would rather be home to enjoy the freedom he has. He can take as much medicine as he wants, drink any alcohol he wants, do anything else he wants to do. Although Jacob recoils at dying alone, he is not frightened by death. Am I scared? About what? Dying? There's no reason to be scared, Jacob states. Jacob touches his parched lips with a long, unclipped fingernail. He reaches for a Bud Light, then fumbles with the pull tab. Those damn Californian pop tops, he mumbles. A friend offers to open the can. Female chauvinist pig, Jacob snarls. The friend pours the beer into a squeeze bottle. Jacob strains to suck the liquid from a straw. At 1 p.m, Jacob announces, pill time! He grimaces as he lifts a duffel bag. If my mother could pick up her purse, I can pick this up, he says, hoisting the bag onto his lap. Inside, he rummages among pyjamas, underwear, toothbrush, toothpaste and disposable razors. He pulls out a bottle of AZT, then nods off. His caretaker lifts the bottle from Jacob's hands and removes 2 capsules. She pushes one into his mouth. Didn't I take those already? A drowsy Jacob asks. Jacob talks of his own funeral. I don't know enough people and I'm not far enough up in society to have a big whoop-de-doo. He wants to be cremated and he'd like mourners to offer a toast with tequila sangria, his favourite drink. What will they say about me when I'm gone? They'll probably say, rotten bum, he owed me $12. I want to say something, Jacob says weakly, as if he's rehearsed a monologue. Sex is a wonderful, beautiful thing, but always get yourself checked. To go through what I've been going through is, his voice trails away. Not worth it, he finishes. Jacob rests his head on his pillow. Do you want this to be your last journal? The reporter asks. Knowing this means the next journal, the final chapter, would be written after his death. Jacob nods, yes. He pulls a handful of Kleenex to his face and sobs. Thank you. Then, on the 7th of October 1990, Illinois Herald and Review newspaper, on their front page, print a large photograph of Dave looking visibly gaunt in his hospital bed with the caption, "Facing the End." And the article has the headline, "His name was Dave." And it goes on to state, "Most people knew him as Jacob, but his name was Dave. And now, his long struggle against AIDS is over." Dave Partridge, who chronicled his 3-year battle with AIDS in Jacob's journal in the Herald and Review, died at 2:15 a.m. Saturday, the day prior, 6th of October 1990, in Decatur Memorial Hospital. He was 33. A memorial service for Dave will be held at 10 a.m. Wednesday at J.J. Moran and Son's funeral home. Plans are to cremate Dave's body and bury his ashes near the grave of his stepfather, who died in May. It was Dave's wish that his real name be revealed upon his death. He had used the pen name Jacob to protect the privacy of family and friends. In the end, Dave not only wanted his name revealed, but he also allowed the Herald and Review to record his last days in words and pictures. This was his personal legacy, a searing reminder of the horrors of AIDS. As Jacob, Dave shared the experience of living with AIDS by keeping a journal that began on November the 22nd, 1987, in the newspaper and ended 33 chapters later on September the 9th, 1990. Diagnosed with AIDS in the summer of 1987, Dave couldn't pinpoint when he contracted AIDS. He used and even manufactured intravenous drugs, stopping only when his arm, quote, "began to look like it had gone through a sewing machine," end quote, according to a journal entry. And avowed homosexual, Dave once confessed, "Back then, bisexual and casual sex seemed to be the fashion, and I was fashionable." During his 3 years with AIDS, Dave's weakened immune system succumbed to many ills, among them pneumonia, tuberculosis, and a cancer common among AIDS patients, Kaposi sarcoma. There wasn't one thing that killed Dave, it was all of them. Each time he battled back, his body was left a little more worn. In the midst of his final fight for life, Dave entered Decatur Memorial Hospital on September the 10th. He remained there until his death. Dave spent his last days in room 2475, his shrunken body dwarfed by the hospital bed. Dave's condition deteriorated steadily during his 26-day hospital stay. He grew weak. During the early days, he was restrained, literally tied to the bed, so he wouldn't take dangerous, unsupervised walks. By the end, the ties were unnecessary. He was too feeble to even sit or stand. Once independent and free-spirited, Dave grew increasingly unhappy and frustrated with his own helplessness. He refused to eat. Nurses and friends noted a growing despondency in the last few days. He seemed to give up, give in to death. Friday evening, just hours before his death, Dave had his final visitor. Too weak to converse, Dave lay on his side, his head flat on the bed. He slept with his eyes open, but unfocused. Occasionally he stirred, staring intently at the visitor, almost camouflaged in protective mask, gloves and gown. The garb was meant to protect Dave from any visitor's germs, as well as protect visitors against AIDS. When the late night visitor tried to leave, he grabbed her hand and pleaded weakly, "No, don't go." Agreeing to stay, the visitor pulled a chair to the bedside, where she could keep her hand on Dave's. "Hurry," he urged. About 8 p.m. with Dave sleeping sporadically, the visitor got up. "I'll see you tomorrow," she said. Dave nodded and smiled. At 2 a.m, a nurse checked on Dave. Seeing his condition had worsened, she scurried down the hallway to the nurse's station. There, she telephoned Dave's family and friends. "Dave's not doing well, you better come," she warned. Hanging up, the nurse returned to Dave's room. It was too late. Dave's worst fear had been realised. He had died alone.
"I'd give a million to morrows for just one yesterday."
By the time family and friends gathered in the dark hospital corridor, Dave's body was clean, his limbs neatly arranged under a crisp white sheet pulled up to his chin. The look of pain had vanished from his face. At 5:55 a.m, Dave's mother, Rose Wilson, and his brother, Michael Partridge, arrived from nearby cities. Within 30 minutes, they were joined by Dave's dear friend, 88-year-old Blanche Wolfe. Wolfe had written to Dave after his first journal. The two became fast friends, with Dave dubbing Wolfe Grandma. Silently, their arms around each other, Dave's friends and relatives made the long, dreaded walk to the end of the hall to view his body. They clustered in Dave's quiet room, already stripped of all personal effects. A small light at the end of the bed cast a peaceful halo of light over the room. "My baby's gone," Rose sobbed, touching her son's hand through the sheet. Grandma dabbed her eyes with a handkerchief. "Before I read his journal, I thought AIDS patients could lie down in the gutter. I figured they'd got what they deserved. What's changed my mind?" She motioned towards Dave's body. "Him. There was something special in that boy." As we heard in that article, it was Dave's wish for his friend and journalist, Amy Ragsdale, at the Herald and Review, to share his final moments in both words and photos as the last chapter of his journal. This poignant tribute came just 4 days after his death on the 10th of October 1990, when the Herald and Review featured a striking photograph of Dave seated on that blue velvet sofa, accompanied by the headline, "The Face of AIDS." This was more than a feature. It was a heartfelt acknowledgement of a life cut short, and a call to recognise the humanity behind the headlines, where the article states, "It was Partridge's wish that his real name be revealed after his death. He had used the pen name Jacob to protect friends and family. Now, in words and photos, Partridge allows a look at his final days. Today, he gives AIDS a name and a face." For some, Partridge's story was hard to digest. He wasn't an innocent boy with haemophilia who contracted AIDS through tainted blood products. And he wasn't an older man suffering a mistake of a contaminated transfusion. In society's eyes, he was a two-time loser, a homosexual and a former intravenous drug user. In one journal, he confessed, "I personally have known 6 people that have died of AIDS. I was intimate with all of them." Reading that, some responded, quote, "AIDS was good enough for him," end quote. Like Partridge, the greatest percentage of Illinois' diagnosed AIDS patients have been between the ages of 30 and 39. Like Partridge, most are white. Partridge fell into the two biggest AIDS risk groups. Currently in Illinois, 71% of AIDS patients are homosexual or bisexual men. Intravenous drug users account for another 13%. At first, Rose Wilson did not approve of her son's decision to share his story of AIDS with the world. "I thought we should keep it quiet," she later explained. Rose, 66, now looks back, remembering how she came to terms with her youngest son's life and death. "Just knowing David was gay tore me up, but I learned to accept it. When I found out he had AIDS, I was heartbroken, devastated. When David was first diagnosed, I knew only that AIDS was a deadly disease with no cure. I was mad. Why did it have to happen to me, to my child? I withdrew. I didn't want to be around anybody. I thought everybody was talking about me. For 6 months, I screamed and cried all the time. Finally, a girlfriend recommended a psychologist. One day, I went to the psychologist's office and started beating on the desk, screaming, 'I'm so goddamn tired of laughing on the outside and crying on the inside.' I blamed myself. The psychologist told me it wasn't my fault. To other mothers of AIDS patients, I say, accept it. There's nothing you can do about it. It has to be the will of God." At first, like many AIDS patients, Partridge appeared perfectly healthy. But inside, the virus was attacking his body, eroding his defences. Some days he felt fine. Other days his system was racked by diarrhoea and nausea. AIDS is a condition marked by plateaus. Struck by an illness, the weakening immune system struggles to rally. Partridge fought setbacks. Histiocytosis, tuberculosis, 3 bouts with pneumonia, sinus polyps, a yeast infection of the mouth, herpes, and an age-related cancer called Kaposi sarcoma. Drugs like the life-prolonging AZT helped his body fight. He'd recover, then spend weeks or months coasting in relatively good health. More than a half dozen times, Partridge ended up in Decatur Memorial Hospital. He stayed on the cancer unit, usually in a room at the end of the hall. The first time he was hospitalised, Decatur Memorial officials requested the newspaper report Partridge was in a Decatur hospital. Later, with apologies, hospital officials agreed the hospital would be identified. Even those with the most knowledge of the disease feared association with it. Dr. James Wade III was Partridge's physician from the day he was diagnosed with AIDS in 1987. Wade agreed to be part of Jacob's journal, laying aside his fear of possibly being ostracised by some patients. Quote, "I have always admired Dave's courage for stepping out and being willing to express his story with the goal that it might help others," Wade said. Through Jacob's journal, Partridge was able to break down some walls. Evidence came in the form of letters from strangers like Vivian Steinbauer, one of many Central Illinois teachers who found a lesson in Partridge's story. She incorporated Jacob's journal into her class curriculum. Steinbauer's Adult Living at Argentorian High School delves into difficult topics such as AIDS, teen pregnancy, and infant mortality. Quote, "Even though I never had any real contact with Dave, except through the newspaper, I always felt he was part of me and my classroom," Steinbauer said. She goes on to state, "The journals provided a foundation so that everything we learned about AIDS would fit in. We could apply it to a real person, not just some statistic or definition." Some people never accepted Jacob. Quote, "Who cares about him? We'd rather hear about the national budget or the crime in our neighbourhood," said callers who read news of Dave's death. Through it all, there was Grandma, a tiny 88-year-old woman with a Dutch bob haircut and hearing aids in both ears. Blanche Wolfe was Dave's most constant visitor, probably his best friend. Faster than people half her age, she walked the 3 blocks from her apartment to the hospital and sat with Dave for hours. Occasionally she made the trip more than once a day. Only 3 things stood in her way: her volunteer work, rain, and nightfall. Blanche and Dave met soon after Jacob's journal began. Something in his first journal had sparked her attention, prompting her to write to him. Blanche wasn't ignorant about AIDS. One of her sons, John C. Wolfe, who holds a PhD in experimental and theoretical psychology, worked for several months as a chief executive officer of AIDS Project Los Angeles. With each installment of Jacob's journal, Blanche wrote another letter to Dave. "I gave him my name and phone number," she says. "Finally, he called me. I went to his apartment and met him on Memorial Day 1988. In the first conversation, Blanche made it clear she didn't approve of his lifestyle, the homosexuality, or the drug abuse. It wasn't a sermon, just a statement of fact that laid the groundwork for a candid, close relationship. Almost immediately, Dave began calling Blanche Grandma. As the end neared, Grandma's presence reassured Dave. Fearful of going to the hospital and being alone, he cried on the morning the ambulance came. "Grandma, wait until Grandma gets here. I want to talk to Grandma," he said through his tears. In the hospital, Dave continued calling for her. She came, and came, and came. If pain and frustration caused Dave to hurl insensitive comments, they had little effect on Grandma. When one or the other grew weary of talking, they simply sat together, not speaking, but just looking at each other. Sometimes, while he slept in his hospital bed, she dozed in a chair nearby. "That's how you can tell if it's a real friendship," she observed. "When you can just sit there and you don't have to talk," said Grandma. Oh, Dave, what a journey. What a journey. And I have tried to follow up and find out what happened to many of the men that Dave mentioned in his diary, including his ex-partner who went under the alias Edward. And really, I think it's probably best to just keep checking the blog post, because even after this podcast goes out, we will continue to try and tie up those loose ends. So all the updates will be posted on the blog post. And I found and reached out to the now retired journalist and writer, Amy Ragsdale, who played a pivotal role in providing supplementary information regarding the facts and statistics at the height of the AIDS pandemic. Amy's insights were invaluable, and through her collaboration with Dave, the pair developed a working friendship rooted in the shared purpose and commitment to raising awareness around HIV and AIDS. No doubt, like you, I have countless questions I'd love to ask Amy about her work with Dave, and who knows, possibly any tea from their meetings. While I can only hope for a response, there were numerous articles surrounding the publication of Dave's diary in Illinois' Herald and Review newspaper that provided insight into Dave's writing. The articles delve into the significance of Dave's diary as a window into his experiences and emotional landscape, illustrating how his words resonate with readers and offer a glimpse into his unique perspective. And you may remember in Chapter 8 that we covered in Episode 1, Dave, in his diary entry under the alias Jacob, Amy Ragsdale highlighted a poignant moment when Dave reflects on a column the newspaper had ran the previous Sunday, the 28th of February 1988, where Amy offered the following insight. Quote, "Last week, Herald and Review editor Thomas L. Blount wrote a column about the mail Jacob has received since he began sharing his journal. Blount referred to Jacob's lack of formal education. Jacob dropped out of high school but later earned a GED, high school equivalency diploma. While reading Blount's column, Jacob paused and commented on the part about his schooling." End quote. And I found this article, and we just need to note and remember that this article was published on the 28th of February 1988, so we're only around 4 months into his journal being published in the Herald and Review, so Dave is still using the alias Jacob. His name is Jacob and he has AIDS. Upon request by the Herald and Review, Jacob began keeping a diary in mid-November to record his life as it is stolen by AIDS. Quote, "He volunteered to tell his story because he believes people need to know that AIDS is a problem here in Decatur, not just in big cities." End quote. According to the explanation that ran with part one of the series, Living with AIDS. The Herald and Review asked Jacob to tell his story because, as Carol Alexander, assistant managing editor, put it, "It's one of the most high-profile health issues of our time. Last year, it was the health problem." She points out that in telling the AIDS story, she didn't want a reporter to write stories about AIDS victims. Quote, "That's already been done. We didn't want to be a mimic." End quote. "We wanted to tell the AIDS story a different way, and reporter Amy Ragsdale wanted to be involved in telling it. Quote, "It's the ultimate way to give people information about AIDS," she says. "Decatur is a very difficult place in which to write stories about AIDS. The gay community is closeted, it's a conservative community, even some doctors don't want to talk," she added. The two big reasons for her intense interest, one, quote, "It's a local person saying, I have AIDS and I'm going to tell you about it. It forces all of us to confront it." Two, quote, "We've answered every question you can imagine, and still they ask questions. They believe it when he tells them the answers," end quote. Ragsdale readily admits, quote, "We looked, L-U-C-K-E-D, we looked into it when asked how we found someone to share living with AIDS with us. Quote, someone concerned about confidentiality called me," she says. "And one thing led to another that led to contact with Jacob. He agreed to tell his story in print if we didn't use his real name." Again, Alexander insisted that, quote, "The story shouldn't be ours, but his diary." Alexandra admits, at first glance, she didn't see Jacob as ideal. Quote, "He's not a writer, he's not highly educated, but he's an ordinary type person," end quote. And that's who she wanted telling this tale. She admits to, quote, "The first draft was not usable, full of generalities and platitudes and philosophy. He didn't know what made a diary," end quote. Alexander suggested Ragsdale check out the diary by which Samuel, quote, "Heaps is chiefly known, kept between his 27th and 36th year, revealing on every page the capacity for selecting the small, as well as the large, essential that conveys the sense of life," according to Encyclopedia Britannica. Ragsdale did check out the book, read a little bit of it, determined it was too much for Jacob to handle, but explained to Jacob how to use some of the methods in such a diary. Ragsdale has worked with Jacob, helping him with punctuation and to better explain some things to readers by asking, quote, "What does that mean? How? Why?" and other questions. In some ways, it's a joint project. They produce a report every couple of weeks. Jacob did write in the journal every day, at first, but prefers a notepad and switched to it. Ragsdale reads through Jacob's notes on the notepad, looks for different themes and numbers them. Then, Jacob dictates from the notes and adds his thoughts and Ragsdale types them. The February 22nd segment, Chapter 7, resulted from a little different method. Jacob, who sometimes gets exhausted from the process, had, quote, "jotted notes on the pad, but got frustrated and depressed and had thrown them away," Ragsdale says. "So, he had to tell me how he was feeling and I just typed what he said, asking a question here and there," end quote. Alexander, the assistant editor, was extremely happy with the results. Quote, "The last chapter, Chapter 7, which ran on Monday, was the best. It was what we've been looking for. It, I think, was literature. End quote. And the editor writing this article, Thomas L. Blount, concludes, I could write a lot about what Jacob's Journal means to the Herald and Review and its readers. Instead, I'll let those who have responded in writing to Jacob tell you. And at the bottom of the page in a side article titled From Jacob's Mailbag, the article states, excerpts from letters to Jacob which he shared with us. Quote, your courage and compassion in what must be a painful process is most admirable. Perhaps it will be of some comfort to you to know that, at least in this one instance, your story is having the effect you intended. People are gaining understanding and empathy for AIDS victims. End quote. Writer tells of a healthcare professional who uses Jacob's Journal in workshops to teach other healthcare personnel how to treat AIDS patients. Quote, your words add a personal impact to what would otherwise be a cold, clinical, impersonal presentation. End quote. And that letter was from a local woman with a husband and daughter in healthcare fields. Another letter, quote, I have been very touched by what I have read. You are a brave and wonderful person to let this very private part of your life become public in order that others might understand and learn more about AIDS. And that letter is cited as female. And this next letter came from a 25-year-old female reader who wrote, the first time I picked up the Sunday paper and read your installment from your journal, it was a story about a stranger who had this disease that didn't seem real to me because it hasn't affected anyone I know yet. After I read your fourth installment, I wept because you're my friend and I'm angry and sad that this disease causes you to suffer. It's amazing to think of the number of lives you will touch and improve directly and indirectly. I am Edward's age and my husband is close to your age, so I was trying to imagine what it would be like to have to see the person I love with all my heart go through so much pain. I can't even imagine what it would be like. Thank you so much for taking the opportunity to make such a profound difference in so many lives. And this next quote came from a girl in Hammond. Today, when I read your article, I started to cry. Even though I don't know you in person, I feel close to you. And this next excerpt from a letter came from a Decatur grandmother who wrote, your age falls in the age range of my grandchildren. So you see, I'm just an old grandmother, writing to tell you I care about you. Your articles have made me do a lot of thinking and soul-searching that I wouldn't have thought of doing had you not published them. So, you just don't know how many people you are helping by publishing what you have written. And this next quote from a letter comes from somebody who is cited as a Decatur gay. Jacob, I only know you from the paper, but I cry with you. And when you hurt, I hurt. End quote. And this next quote comes from a girl from Newman who wrote, I saw your article in the Herald and Review while I was at Sunday school. We discussed your situation in class. We all talked about how devastating it must be. This next line from a letter came from a 15-year-old girl who wrote, reading your journal, I feel almost as if I know you. And a 16-year-old Decatur girl also wrote, I enjoy your journal in the sense that it educates me and helps me understand AIDS just a little bit better. It also gives me the answers to questions that no one else can answer. And this next line came from a female who wrote, people that have the combination of courage and humour that you do are an inspiration to all of us. And this next line came from a letter from a mother of 8 children and 8 foster children who wrote, I just hope we have as much compassion for that one different sheep as you have had for us by sharing your life so that we might be better informed. And another Decatur grandmother wrote, I just wish there was something I could do. Maybe you could let me adopt you as my grandson. Now maybe that's Grandma Blanche Wolf. And this final excerpt came from a female minister who wrote, I have been deeply moved by your stories. You seem to have a great deal of honest self-awareness, courage, and wisdom. I am a minister. I want to reaffirm your beliefs. You have given the Decatur community a real gift, the gift of yourself. Being a pastor, I know there is a very real chance that I will someday minister to someone whose life is touched by AIDS. I thank you from the depths of my being for having prepared me, at least as prepared as one can be for this kind of thing, if and when this day comes. Oh, what wonderful insight. What amazing feedback for Dave, especially when he is at that point. He's only 7 chapters into sharing his life now living with AIDS. Just, oh, so wonderful letters that he received. Then, shortly after chapter 16, which was published on the 12th of September 1988, the Herald and Review on the 25th of September 1988 ran the headline, AIDS Diary Earns Herald and Review Reporter Prize, where they reported, Jacob's Journal, the real-life story of a Decatur AIDS victim, has won first prize in a contest sponsored by Illinois Department of Public Health for excellence in reporting on AIDS. The series, produced by health writer Emmy Ragsdale, took top honours in the contest designed to, quote, inform, educate, and motivate Illinois residents to prevent the spread of AIDS, end quote. It won in the category of newspapers with $50,000 or less circulation. The prize carries a $1,000 cash reward from Abbott Laboratories. Ragsdale will be sharing a portion of the prize with Jacob, the 31-year-old Decatur AIDS victim whose diary is used. To protect his family and friends, Jacob does not use his real name. In awarding the prize, Dr. Bernard Turnock of the Illinois Department of Public Health wrote, "Your courageous, sensitive use of a person with AIDS diary entries, more than any other news coverage judged, fosters compassion and lets your readers see that beyond the statistics and legislation and politics, AIDS has a name and a face. Our judges from Northwestern University's Medhill School of Journalism complimented your ability to draw your readers into Jacob's plight while teaching them a great deal about the disease," end quote. 16 chapters of Jacob's Journal have appeared in the Herald and Review. It started in November 1987, about 3 months after Jacob learned he had AIDS. During the last year, Jacob has written about his bouts with pneumonia and tuberculosis. He has chronicled problems with family and friends and has written about breaking up with his lover. While doing the journal, Ragsdale often takes notes as Jacob dictates from his diary. Ragsdale then supplements Jacob's words with information about the disease, statistics and background information from other sources, including doctors and agencies working with AIDS patients. Ragsdale, who has been with the Herald and Review for nearly 3 years, said, quote, "Writing Jacob's Journal has taught me a lot about AIDS and given me the chance to share that with readers, things like what a person who has AIDS faces, medically, physically, emotionally and socially, and how the medical and social service community react," end quote. Jacob said, quote, "The recognition is greatly appreciated. I'm proud. The journal is meant to help educate. It's important that people understand. My story deals with real life, not a made-up fantasy," end quote. Entries were judged on the basis of public education value in promoting better understanding of AIDS and the prevention of AIDS, initiative, originality, scientific accuracy, and excellence in writing. While the award indeed highlights Ragsdale's valuable supplementary insights on AIDS, it is Dave's diary that forms the emotional core of the publication. First prize transcends the initial criticism from the assistant editor, who dismissively stated that Dave was, quote, "not a writer, he's not highly educated." In contrast, the raw and unblemished nature of Dave's experiences resonate on a profound level, offering readers a poignant glimpse into the realities of living with AIDS. And despite an ocean of decades, much, if not all, except the premature death aspect, is very much the same today for people like me and others living with HIV, living with a legacy of AIDS and HIV stigma. Now, I don't know about you, but Dave Partridge's voice emerged as both moving and illuminating, challenging preconceived notions of what constitutes meaningful storytelling. And shortly after chapter 26 in September 1989, the Herald and Review on the 17th of September 1989 ran the headline, "Herald and Review Takes 6 State Contest Awards," where they report they have won 6 awards in the 1989 Illinois Press Association Newspaper Contest, where, further down the article, they report, health writer Amy Ragsdale took second place honours in Best Coverage of Medicine for the series Jacob's Story, Living with AIDS. Quote, "To get beyond the barrier of fear and ignorance regarding AIDS seems almost impossible, but Amy Ragsdale and AIDS victim Jacob have accomplished this with Jacob's candid ongoing story, accompanied by Ragsdale's elucidation of medical, social and legal concerns. And while these articles allude to recognising Dave Partridge's diary, Dave Partridge wasn't really recognised as a writer until, boldly, the Chicago Tribune published an obituary 3 days after his death, where the header states, "Writer Dave Partridge chronicled AIDS battle," where they wrote, "Dave Partridge, whose 3-year battle with AIDS was chronicled in a series of first-person stories in the Decatur Herald and Review, died Saturday in Decatur Memorial Hospital. He was 33. Jacob's Journal began running in November 1987, according to Amy Ragsdale, the health writer. Mr. Partridge's first writing efforts were poetry, which were not published, Ragsdale said. They developed a system in which Mr. Partridge would write his thoughts and comments in a notebook. Mr. Partridge then would dictate to Ragsdale, who would insert any needed background information. Quote, "The journal was always a team project. We always used his words," she said. For example, from the last article, which appeared September the 9th, a day before Mr. Partridge went into the hospital for the final time, quote, "I'm slipping. The doctors say so, but hell, I knew that a long time ago. Nothing can be done, so I might as well accept it. After all, I've done a lot, seen a lot. I realise other AIDS patients have gone through this same slow process, but that doesn't make it any easier." End quote. The 34 journals dealt with such topics as friends who had deserted Mr. Partridge, potential AIDS cures, and relationships. Jacob was a pen name used in order to protect the privacy of family and friends, Ragsdale said. It was Mr. Partridge's wish that his real name be revealed upon his death. Mr. Partridge is survived by his mother, Rose Partridge Wilson, and 2 brothers. A memorial service will be held Wednesday in Decatur. And on that note, Dave's mother passed away at the age of 76 in 2001. And as we heard earlier, Dave Partridge was captured by photographer Dennis McGee in his final chapter of his life, alongside the Herald and Review's front page photograph from the 7th of October 1990 that captured Dave in his hospital bed looking incredibly frail and vulnerable. Well, that photograph and the others went on to win several awards for photographer Dennis McGee, where within the first 6 months after Dave's death, the Herald and Review on the 7th of May 1991 reported, "Herald and Review photographers won 8 awards during the Illinois Press Photographers Association 1990 Pictures of the Year contest last weekend. Dennis McGee won 2nd place in General News with a picture story on AIDS victim Dave Partridge, and a single image from that story both took 3rd place in Feature Picture Story and Portrait Personality, respectively, story by Amy Ragsdale. McGee also won honourable mentions of the AIDS victim after his death, story by Amy Ragsdale. Then, 3 days before the 9th anniversary of Dave Partridge's death, the Herald and Review on the 3rd of October 1999 ran the headline, "Winning picture, worth 1,000 words, with the strapline, "Herald and Review photo, named by Associated Press as one of the top 100 of the century." And the article states, "A 1990 Herald and Review photograph showing a Decatur man in the final stages of AIDS has been selected by the Associated Press as one of its 100 top photos of the century. The picture of AIDS victim Dave Partridge was shot by Herald and Review chief photographer Dennis McGee in Decatur Memorial Hospital during the final stages of Partridge's illness." Quote, "We always talk about pictures as art," McGee said of the newspaper parlance. Quote, "They seldom approach that standard, but this photo had a good mixture of light and content." End quote. And further down the article, Dennis McGee states, "This was one of the first things I worked on after I got here. He, Dave Partridge, never wanted to be identified, but it got to a point where the end was near. He couldn't get out of his house anymore. All the people he knew he was sick. The others, he didn't care about." McGee said he sat for hours with Partridge in the hospital room, noting they weren't friends but achieved a colleague relationship and a mutual respect. Quote, "In the picture, the TV was on, but I'm not sure how much was registering. He was a gay, intravenous drug user who had put himself at risk. No matter what you think of his lifestyle, I came away thinking no one should die like this," McGee said. You know, it's truly amazing to hear that people that worked with Dave Partridge, such as Amy Ragsdale and Dennis McGee, and the Herald and Review newspaper were recognised for their work with Dave and around HIV and AIDS. and full credit must go to the Herald and Review newspaper for so boldly publishing Dave Partridge's his diary. It's truly remarkable. And finally, Dave's physician, James Wade III, wrote a letter to the editor of the Herald and Review newspaper, which was published on the 17th of November 1990, under the headline, Jacob Diary Helped AIDS Education, and the letter states, The Herald and Review deserves commendation for the portrayal in vivid human terms of what AIDS is and does. The unique journal, Jacob, that was published in your newspaper actually portraying the real events of one victim educated many people about the disease. I would like to share a few other aspects of the story. The people who cared for Jacob, Dave, also deserve commendation. The nurses, lab technicians, volunteers, x-ray personnel, physical therapists, pastors, pharmacists, dietitians, social workers, and others at Decatur Memorial Hospital all cared for him with great skill, compassion, encouragement, hope, and empathy. As is customary with any patient, precautions were taken with Dave because of his many bacterial infections. We know that HIV transmission could occur from an accidental needle stick during blood tests, when starting an IV or during surgery, but each professional remained committed to providing Dave with the best treatment and the most comfortable surroundings possible. AIDS, unlike many other diseases, is preventable. We know how to avoid it. I urge the Herald and Review to continue to teach readers in central Illinois the facts so they can prevent this illness. Oh, I echo those sentiments, as I suspect you listening do too, because without the Herald and Review newspaper publishing Dave's diary, his experiences would, like so many others, have remained hidden. The innovative publication and support from journalist Amy Ragsdale have showcased Dave's journey. Additionally, his friends and family have been vital in sharing his story, allowing his voice to resonate beyond his personal accounts. Their loyalty and efforts at a time when, as we know, many turned their backs, honour Dave's memory. Dave Partridge's diary, penned almost four decades ago, remains eerily relevant for those living with HIV today. Although conversations around HIV and AIDS have waned, the struggle faced by individuals with the condition continue to echo Dave's experiences. Modern advancements in medication provide hope with the caveat of a, quote, near-normal life expectancy. Yet, the reality remains stark as many still grapple with issues such as stigma and discrimination, especially in healthcare settings such as hospitals, doctors and dentists. I too have faced rejection from dental providers due to my HIV status. Discrimination in the workplace. The shadow of HIV stigma persists, as evidenced by my ongoing two employment tribunal claims for HIV discrimination. Financial instability looms large for those whose health status complicates job prospects, especially in an evolving welfare landscape that offers little to no support for people living with HIV. And still, concerns regarding opportunist infections, from common colds to more severe threats like pneumonia and more recently COVID-19, exacerbate anxiety. Socially, the fear of rejection still haunts individuals disclosing their status, often compounded by the painful legacy of stigma and the complexities of finding love. The only difference between Dave Partridge's diary and today is the changes in the demographics of infection rates, with heterosexual populations now surpassing those of gay men. The essence of Dave's words resonate just as powerfully today. His diary could seamlessly fit into the contemporary narrative of living with HIV, underscoring that while times may change, the challenges persist. And finally, given the sad circumstances, it feels odd to say that I, and I hope you too, have enjoyed Dave's diary. While his diary was individual to him, it is clear that he had the shared experiences of many who lived and died as a result of AIDS. Dave, through his writing, gave a voice not just to himself but to countless others, encapsulating their struggles, joys and fears. The joy in that is his ability to transform the narrative surrounding the epidemic. His words breathe life into individuals who might otherwise have been reduced to mere statistics. In highlighting their shared humanity, Dave serves as a vital conduit for remembering those lost, ensuring their stories, often silenced, are heard and honoured. For Dave's diary to still have a profound impact almost four decades on is a sign of a truly remarkable legacy. It invites reflection and encourages us to foster a deeper understanding of the epidemic's human cost, a reminder that behind every statistic lies a story and a life that matters. Dave Partridge, we salute you. You can check out and read all the newspaper articles mentioned in this episode, along with extra snippets of information, on the Extra Tea blog. You can find the link in the show notes. If you've enjoyed this episode, then don't forget to like, share and subscribe. Until the next episode, you can find me on Instagram at The Lost Boys of Soho.